Some of you might remember hearing this news story. On May 29th of this year, Gwen Shamblin Lara and her husband, former Tarzan actor Joe Lara, as well as five other leaders within Remnant Fellowship, died in a plane crash in Tennessee. Earlier in May, filmmakers had nearly completed a documentary series about Gwen Shamblin Lara and her Remnant Fellowship, a church in Brentwood, Tennessee, which preached weight loss as a spiritual assignment. For more than 3 years, this team of filmmakers had researched Remnant, which had been facing accusations of being a cult that promoted child abuse. And they were investigating Gwen Lara, a stick-thin woman with a large bouffant hairdo, who gained fame for a theological diet program to pray one's way to thinness. For many years, Shamblin projected a glowing, bubbly facade. She was a self-made Christian businesswoman who devoted herself to helping others, particularly women, achieve their weight loss goals. How to do this? By getting closer to God, she said. Her Way Down workshop, which she started in 1986, preached essentially a theology of intuitive eating. In other words, she said, eat only if your stomach is growling. Pray your way through cravings and resist them. And she explicitly linked diet culture to holiness. She wanted to teach people, this is a quote, how to stop bowing down to the refrigerator and bow down to Him. To God. Food, even now, is theological. On Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, Jews, individually and as a community, reflect and pray. On Yom Kippur, a Jew is required to fast, neither to eat nor to drink, unless by not doing so, they would endanger their own health. Then the rabbi says it is one's duty not to fast, since life is the greatest gift of God, and a gift of God must be sustained. I take that back 75 years ago on Yom Kippur, September 27th, 1944. The Jews of Auschwitz were debating whether or not to fast. We know this because Elie Wiesel wrote about it in his memoir, Night. It was hotly contested, he said. In this place where we were always starving, it was Yom Kippur year round. There are those who said we should fast, precisely because it was dangerous to do so. They were starving. Some said we should fast precisely because it's dangerous to do so. And we will be showing God that even here, locked in this hell, we are capable of singing God's praises. Elie Wiesel took the opposite route, not so much because he wanted to, but because his father, who was still living at the time and was with him in Auschwitz, forbid him to fast. So Elie did not fast, but his reason was not so that God would know even in this hell he was praising God. His reason was opposite. I did it, he says, as a symbol of rebellion, of protest against God. Today, in India, a small number of extreme Hindu nationalists are killing Indian Muslims and Dalits because they eat beef. In the Hindu religion, the cows are revered and sacred. But for the Dalits, the lowest caste, beef is one of the few affordable items that they can eat. And so for choosing to eat and survive, they are being killed by Hindus who hold the cows theologically sacred. Food is theological. It's no wonder that Jesus so often told parables and used illustrations that involve food and eating. On the one hand, eating is basic to our human survival. On the other hand, what we eat and how we eat and with whom we eat reveals a lot about us. Some of Jesus' strongest detractors complained most about the people that Jesus chose to eat with. And after Jesus was gone from the earth, some of the most divisive arguments in that young church erupted over what it was legal to eat, and when, and where, and with whom meals were shared. In today's scriptures, the religious types were especially concerned about Jesus' disciples eating with unclean hands. They hadn't washed appropriately before they ate. So the Pharisees and the teachers of the law asked Jesus, "Why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders instead of eating their food with unclean hands?" To which Jesus replied, "Listen and understand this. Nothing outside a person can defile them by going in. Rather, it's what comes out that defiles them." You know, this kind of concern about ritual cleansing before eating is the kind of thing that we sometimes point out at Christmas time, when those very shepherds that we venerate for flocking to Bethlehem to honor the baby Jesus were some of the most looked down upon members of society. Out in the fields, they couldn't possibly observe all the laws related to ritual cleansing. And you know, even beyond that, Jesus was constantly inviting people to eat with him that others saw as unsuitable, even sinful. If only those attitudes had been buried on Friday and never resurrected. But they weren't. And we deal with all kinds of fallout around food to this day, because food is theological. And food is political. You know, there's a lot of talk these days about where the grocery stores go, where the big chains choose to put their new stores, where green foods and healthy foods are available. But beyond that, there's even more that I think slips underneath our consciousness. Kim Tran wrote an article in which she describes the subversive political nature of food. She's a contributing writer for Everyday Feminism, and she's also a member of Third Woman Press, which is a queer and feminist women of color publishing company. I'm going to share with you a few of the things that she wants to grab a hold of our attention, to shake us out of our complacency. And I'm not going to go into them a great deal. I think it's too tricky to try to do that in 15, 20 minutes on a Sunday morning. But I hope that you will sit with each of these as I introduce them to you, and then I hope you'll leave this place and you'll do more with them. You'll look in them to them more. But here's what Kim Tran says about food. Number one, what we think of as good food is white food. The metrics, she says, that we use to gauge whether or not a restaurant is good, the metrics are racially coded and depend on class. She points out, for example, that one of the ways we review or evaluate a restaurant is on the noise level and the service provided. She points out that to many low and middle class people, especially of color, who own family-run establishments, they often run short on staff because they've run short on family. And they often can't use any of their hard-earned cash for fine table linens or fresh flowers, for which we mark down the restaurant. Number two, she says, racial stereotypes play out in how we conceptualize food. You know, these people eat this stuff. These people eat that stuff. One of the things I challenge you to look into is an article written by Claire Schmidt. She's from the University of Missouri. And she traces certain of our stereotypes about what constitutes black food to the film Birth of a Nation about the founding of the Ku Klux Klan. Kim Tran points out that food has a human cost. We often talk about going vegan as the way to prevent animal cruelty. But she points out that when we go vegan and our diets rely on fresh produce, there is a human cost. There is an animal cost to that as well. One of the statistics she points out is farm workers in Mexico making $6 a day. And then American companies buying that produce and passing them along for a profit. Kim Tran says that access to food is racialized. We know some about this, but do you know this history? Do you know way back in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan went on a personal war against food stamps? Many of in our community remember him for other things, but he went on a personal war against food stamps. In his policy, Reagan talked about food assistance as being a program almost exclusively used by people of color. Statistics say absolutely not. That was not true then. It's not true now. It's never been true. Newt Gingrich was so enamored of what Reagan was saying that he used it as one of his platform items in 2012 in his Republican campaign. Food is political. And food is very, very personal. Many of the statistics I'm about to share with you don't shock us anymore. Roughly 25 million men and 43 million women are, at any given time, dieting to lose weight. Another 21 million men and 26 million women are dieting to maintain weight. In total, there are nearly 116 million adults in the United States dieting at any given time, representing about 55% of the total adult population. 91% of women surveyed on a college campus said that they had attempted to control their weight through dieting. 91% of them, and 22% of them dieted always. 35% of normal dieters progressed to pathological dieting, and of those, 20 to 25% progressed to partial or full syndrome eating disorders. We've become a little bit numb to some of those statistics, but here's what needs to shock us and motivate us to change our words and attitudes around food and how we teach those and how we perpetuate them. 50% of girls between the ages of 11 and 13 see themselves as overweight. And according to Time magazine, 80% of all children have been on a diet by the time they reach fourth grade. Food is personal. I want to end today by sharing with you a passage from one of my theological sheroes, Anne Lamott. She's a mess. If you've heard about her in the news lately, it's probably because of some very disturbing things that you wish she hadn't said, and I wish she hadn't said, but oh, she's brave. She's a brave mess. And so I end this morning by sharing with you one of the sections of one of her books. This is a conversation that she had one day with her psychologist, Rita. Anne had at that time been struggling with food addictions and eating disorders for most of her adult life. And this is the conversation she had one day with her psychologist, Rita. Rita asked me what I had for breakfast. Cereal, I said. And were you hungry when you ate it? What do you mean? I asked. I mean, did you experience hunger and then did you make breakfast? I don't really understand what you're asking. Let me put it this way, the psychologist said. Why did you have breakfast? Oh, I see. I had breakfast because it was breakfast time. But were you hungry? I stared at her a moment. Is this like a trick question? No, she said. I just want to know how you know it's time to eat. I know it's time to eat because it's meal time, Anne said. It's morning, so I eat breakfast, or it's midday, so I eat lunch, and so on. Anne writes, Rita finally asked me what it felt like when I was hungry, and I could not answer. I asked her to explain what it felt like when she was hungry, and she described a sensation in her stomach of emptiness, an awareness of appetite. So for the next week, my assignment was to notice what it felt like when I was hungry. It was so strange. I was once again the world's oldest toddler. I walked around peering down as if to look into my stomach, like it was one of those old-fashioned washing machines where you can see the soapy water swirling your clothes. And I paid attention until I was able to isolate this feeling in my stomach, this gritchy kind of emptiness, like a rat was scratching at the door wanting to be let in. Anne told her psychologist, wonderful, she said, and then gave me my next assignment. First to notice when I was hungry, and then, this blew my mind, Anne writes, to feed myself. All of a sudden, I was Helen Keller after she breaks the code for water. I'd feel the scratchy emptiness in my belly, and I'd mention to myself that I seemed hungry, and then I'd ask myself in a deeply maternal way, what I felt like eating. Well, actually, I feel like some Cheetos, I might say. So I'd go and buy some Cheetos and put some in a bowl and eat them, and God, it was so amazing. And then I'd check in with myself, would you like some more, I'd ask. No, I'd say, but don't throw them out. It got better. I'm hungry. I'd say to myself, I'd like some frosting. Okay, I'd tell myself, and some Cheetos. So I'd have some frosting and some Cheetos for breakfast. I'd eat for a while, and then I'd check in with myself very kindly. Would you like more? Not now, I'd say, but don't throw them away. I might want them later. I ate frosting and Cheetos and cookies for weeks. I'd buy half a dozen and keep them on the kitchen counter. It was terrifying, like knowing there were snakes in my kitchen. I'd eat a little, stop when I was no longer hungry. Want one more cookie, dear? I'd ask. No, thanks. But I might want one later. Don't throw them out. Finally, Anlma ends this story with her impossible heroic honesty. Over these years, my body has not gotten firmer. Just the opposite, in fact. But when I feel fattest and flabbiest and most repulsive, I try to remember that gravity speaks. Also, that no one needs that plastic body perfection from women of age and substance. Also, that I do not live in my thighs or in my droopy butt. I live in joy and motion and cover-ups. I live in the nourishment of food and the sun and the warmth of the people who love me. I believe that's why Jesus talked about food all the time. Are you hungry? He asked very lovingly. Are you hungry? I can help with that. Amen.